to order. I think we have everybody but one of our committee members, but we're going to start with a public hearing. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2327. And we have Representative Morgan, whose bill it is. But first I'm going to have, while you come up to the dais, I'll have Patrick give a little overview of what we're going to be hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2327 establishes state policy for funding fire protection. It directs the Department of Forestry to include specific budget requests on forms submitted to DAS and creates Oregon Fire Protection Contingency Fund, specifies the sources of monies for the fund, and provides for the use of monies from the fund. Prohibits state agencies from interfering with landowners taking action to suppress fire on their land, except in cases where such action would increase the risk of injury to persons or equipment. The measure reduces or eliminates the harvest tax and assessments depending on the amount held in the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. It removes the sunset on increases in the reserve base and appropriates $900,000 from the general fund for payment of catastrophic fire insurance. The bill has an emergency clause that sets an effective date of March 1st, 2005. The measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and included in your packets is a fiscal impact analysis for the Dash 1 amendments, which are also included in your packet. And I think Charlie Stone will be speaking to the fiscal impact statement when he speaks.
Thank you, Patrick. I think we're ready to proceed. Representative Morgan, good morning.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's good to be here. For the record, I'm State Representative Susan Morgan, and I represent House District 2, which is the southern part of Douglas County, and a little bit of Josephine and Jackson counties. And what we'd like to do for you today is to, the part of the presentation that I have, I'd like to go over discussing for you, or with you, the need for the bill and the situation that arose that caused us to move in this direction. The results of a work group that's been working over the last year on this issue, who was on the work group, what the process was that we went through to come up with this legislative proposal, what some of the key recommendations are that we built the proposal around, and then to talk to you a little bit about the structure of the flow of this legislation through the system. My colleague here, Charlie Stone from the department, will take you through the details of the bill and take you through the amendments that we're going to ask you to move into the bill, and then take you through the fiscal impact statement that has been brought out by the Legislative Fiscal Office. So let's just kind of jump into this then. What triggered the whole work group that had took place over the past year was a discussion in the Ways and Means Subcommittee, the Natural Resources Subcommittee, during the last budget cycle. And we had great concerns as we were deliberating about fire funding in the state that the insurance policy that the state has bought for a long period of time, the premium was going up on it and the coverage was coming down. And we were in a place where it made a lot of sense to take a look at the relationship between the cost and the benefit of the policy and just decide whether that was a good tool to keep in the toolbox or not. So the there had been great instability in the insurance markets because of the 9/11 issues, and I think those of you that pay your homeowner's premium and your auto premium had also experienced some of that instability, and it lapped over into the issue that the state was facing with the fire insurance policy. We also felt that it was appropriate to take a look at the funding formula for firefighting because the formula hadn't been reviewed for about 15 years, and there were a number of things that had developed over that time and a number of things looking into the future that needed to be factored into the funding formula in order for the state to have a good formula that actually met the needs of firefighting. So we came together under the label of the budget note number 3 work group, which this was the third budget note in the Department of Forestry's budget. There were 9 legislators that served on this panel, and there also were a diverse group of stakeholders. The members of the panel, I was the chair. Senator Schrader served on it, Representative Krieger, Senator Westland, Representative Hobson, Senator Metzger, Representative Krupp, Senator Farioli, and now Senator Johnson. We had Sue Richardson, who was the Southwest Area Manager for the Bureau of Land Management, Rod Green, who is a forester and serves on the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, Ray Wilkerson from the Oregon Forest Industries Council, Christina McNitt from the Small Woodlands Association, Greg Addington from the Farm Bureau, Susie Jordan from the Legislative Fiscal Office, Christina Shearer from the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management, Andrea Parker from the Department of Administrative Services, who oversees issues related to insurance policies, Nancy Orr from the State Fire Marshal's Office, Clark Seely and Charlie from the Department, and a number of other people who just kind of came to the meetings because they were interested in it. And we have had 10 meetings over the past year. We started on January the 14th of 2004 and finished up just before Christmas, the Christmas that just passed. And what I'll do is draw your attention to a document that you have in front of you that says Principles for Refining Fire Program Funding. One of the things that we did in the work group was to take a look at a large volume of data to try to get our hands around the dynamic of firefighting. And as a result of those data discussions and our policy discussions, we drew up this document, which was the principles that we wanted to move forward with in actually discussing a specific funding formula. And I think that as you have a policy discussion around this bill, it would be important for you to understand where we came from a principal perspective on this, and so I'd like to take a little time to go through these. The first thing that we started with was a clear premise that Oregon has an outstanding firefighting system on the ground right now. This is a world-class operation, and people do come from all over the world to study the way that the department and all of the agencies that work together down through the firefighting structure, how all that works and how things happen in Oregon, because we have a system that we should be very proud of. I went over the issue with the insurance markets, but that was a big issue. We looked at that in great detail in the work group and decided that the markets had somewhat stabilized and that this was a viable tool and a valuable tool to keep in the firefighting toolbox. We looked at self-insurance alternatives with DAS helping us through that process, and the problem that we came up there with in that area was that it's probably a good long-term goal for the state. But in the cash situation that the state's in right now, a self-insurance program involves a large infusion of cash up front, and we were not in a position to expect that to be a place where the state could go this time because of the fiscal realities. So we also looked at things like pooling with other states and possibly provinces to form a pool, but kind of came to a dead end on that one too, because we really, the way we fight fire here is much more effective than the way they fight it in other states, and we felt that we would ultimately be putting ourselves at somewhat of a disadvantage by combining with people that we really had no control over and didn't have as good of a record as we had. So that one kind of went by the boards too. And the insurance policy emerged as being the clear choice to as the tool to keep in the toolbox. The one thing that we did talk about was that the biggest drain on the general fund, the biggest exposure to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, was catastrophic wildfires. Fires that got big are very, very expensive to fight, and they draw the cash reserves of the system down very quickly. So in order to look into the future to protect the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, the best thing that we could do to do that was either prevent fires from starting or get them out while they were small and avoid those catastrophic costs. And so we were searching for ways to do that. One of the concepts that we came up with, given that we're in a very financially constrained biennium this time, we decided to look for solutions to this within the framework of the money that is already spent on fire funding. We didn't want to look for any big new infusions of cash, because that was going to be a very, this is a difficult budget environment to have that discussion. So what we looked at was there's a potential to raise the deductible on the fire insurance policy, which would lower the cost of the policy. So money that would, in previous scenarios, go to buying that policy would then be freed up, and we could look at moving that policy farther down in the use hierarchy and using that on prevention and what's called severity funding. And severity funding is something that the committee talked a lot about. And the concept around severity funding is that you can look statistically at the history of fires in the state, and it becomes very clear that there are certain areas of the states where fires start and burn, and there are certain times of the year when that happens, and that you would be well served looking into the future to plan a firefighting arrangement or plan around the need to have people and equipment to fight fires stationed in pretty particular parts of the state so you could get to those fires while they were small and get them out. And the areas where, we all know where they are, Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon and Josephine and Jackson County and Southern Oregon have a history of very catastrophic wildfires. So over the last few funding cycles, the Department of Forestry has been coming to this process and asking for what's called severity funding, and it has historically been tucked into the emergency board allotments. The department takes that money and uses it to contract for helicopters and different pieces of large equipment like that and place that equipment in the high-risk areas of the state. And we have a significant body of factual information that shows that that's a really effective way of getting fires out. We can have water on those fires and retardant on those fires in very short order. And we could spend the rest of the day telling you stories about how these severity resources have saved a lot of acreage from burning and saved the general fund from a lot of drawdown. So looking at ways to put more money into prevention and into severity funding was one of the places where the work group was very interested in going. The other thing that we wanted to recognize is that the general fund is the payer of last resort with the bill. When the bill comes due on wildfire, if the resources aren't there from other directions, the general fund pays the tab. So you're in a clear situation where you either pay up front and try to prevent fires from draining the fund down, or you let nature take its course and you just take your chances and the bill comes to the general fund at the end of it. So a pay now or pay later mentality in the funding group was very clear, and what we wanted to do was to do everything that we could do to lower the risk to the general fund over time. The large fires in the system often result from the system being overwhelmed. If there's a lightning storm, and the 2002 fire season is a great example of this, where a very wide-ranging lightning storm came over the whole southern part of the state and started a large, large number of fires that just overwhelmed the system. So we wanted to try to provide resources that would mitigate in that situation so that we could try to avoid catastrophic fires from building in that scenario. I've talked about the areas of the state where historically there are more fires. The other piece of that is that there are areas of the state that simply have low land values, and those people don't have a lot of ability on the local level to put resources into the system. And so a successful forward-looking funding scenario had to take that into effect, that there were lower land values in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon, and we needed to mitigate for that too. We got into a pretty detailed discussion around the balance of funding between the landowners and the state of Oregon through the general fund, how much of it the taxpayers bear. And spent a lot of time trying to kind of lay all of the funding cards and the service using cards face up on the table so we could take a look across all the areas that this was funded. And it's a very multifaceted cross-jurisdictional effort that takes place to keep fires under control, and it goes all the way from the federal government down to local jurisdictions. There's a lot of people involved in this at a lot of levels. We came up, after working through all these issues, with kind of a quick and dirty 50,000-foot look at about 60% of the costs are borne by the landowners. About 40% of the costs are borne by the people of Oregon through general fund contributions to the process. We talked about the public benefits to firefighting, the issues around the quality of the environment, the quality of the air, the quality of the water, the economic development issues, the public safety issues, the transportation issues, all of the benefits that are derived by the state as a whole by having a responsive firefighting effort in place that will put fires out while they're small or prevent fires. We talked about the benefits to the rural communities of having a vibrant firefighting program. We talked about the benefits to the industrial landowners and the small timberland owners of having a system in place that keeps fires out. And what we came up with was that it is probably reasonable to try to move the funding scenario closer to a 50-50 place, that where the general fund would be bearing more of the cost than the private landowners are bearing right now. But we also are very mindful of the fiscal environment that we're in right now, and the probability of moving in that direction is a place where we didn't feel that it was going to be fruitful to go. And so there are maybe one little tiny baby step in here that moves us in that direction that Charlie will talk about. But basically, we wanted to just introduce language in the bill so that concept was in statute and was something that could be discussed in future sessions of the legislature. That, I think, is pretty much an overview of the philosophy. The process that we're in here, this is a bill that has policy implications and it also has budget implications. So it's one of those bills that will go from the policy side, the policy committee being this one, into the ways and means process. What we would be very interested in having you talk about here are the policy implications of this bill, whether you think the principles that we went forward on are sound principles, whether you think this bill is a sound way to look at dealing with wildfire over the next 15 or 20 years. We have found a few things that we would rather have done differently when we drafted the bills, and those are in the Dash 1 amendments that are before you. If you will refer this bill down to Ways and Means, when it gets into the Natural Resources Subcommittee on Ways and Means, we'll have a discussion around how we'll factor the financial issues into it. Senator Beyer has brought up a very good issue on the cap on the landowner assessment and when the fund fills up, how far to draw it down before you start filling the fund up again. That's an issue that we'll take up down in the Ways and Means part of the process. So I would ask you just to be concerned with the policy side of this. Put on record any issues that you have at the funding side of us, but let us deal with the funding issues down in the Ways and Means parts of the process. And then just to summarize, this is one of the best work groups that I've ever been involved in. I think that the scope of the discussions and the seriousness of the discussions and the focus on driving towards a workable, valuable work product, this work group was better than anything, any of the work groups that I can remember working on. And I do commend the people that took all of their time to come and be part of the process. There was a significant feedback loop back into the stakeholder groups to make sure that we were not going to go in a direction that was going to ultimately be harmful for them. I think this is an outstanding product. I'm really proud of the work that we have before you today, and I do very clearly believe that this is a very solid way to take fire funding over the next 15 or 20 years in the state of Oregon. And with that, I would entertain questions or turn it over to Charlie to actually do the technical part.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Are there any questions for the representative before we proceed? You must have done a great Representative Hass.
Thank you. I feel I'm supportive, but I feel like I should ask you about one of the points that you made, Representative, about in your principles, that this would preclude raising protection rates on landowners to the degree required to cover actual costs. Can you tell me who the landowners are that are affected, and can you just explore that a little bit?
Charlie, could I pass that one off to you?
I'm not sure the reference back on, for the record, Charlie Stone with the Department of Forestry, but what was the statement again that you're trying to clarify?
The low value of land and resources in these areas preclude raising protection rates.
Okay.
To the degree required.
That was a reference to the issues that are going on, particularly in eastern Oregon right now, where the private timberland is in a growth cycle, and the land value, because it's such an arid part of the state and the growth rates on the timber are so low, the land values there are very low, and the ability of the landowners to put significant amounts of money into firefighting just isn't there. That's one of the areas of the state where fire is a huge issue. And so we wanted to recognize that inequity between areas that use a lot of firefighting services but don't have the financial ability to contribute up to the level that they use them, that there is a responsibility on the part of the system as a whole to recognize that and deal with that in a constructive way.
Chair Smith, if I might add a little bit to that, just for put some numbers on it. Excuse me. In northwest Oregon, the private landowner pays an assessment typically from somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 cents to 90 cents an acre to provide the protection that's adequate on the west side, and the timber values and all that pay for that reasonably readily. I would say that the landowners probably still are concerned about the cost. But on the east side, for instance, the Central Oregon District, the Walker Range District, they're paying an assessment of in the neighborhood of $1.18 an acre to achieve an adequate level of protection. And when we challenge them and say, well, gee, could you add another engine crew or a helicopter and that would push that rate up even higher, they're starting to say, we just can't afford the additional amount of protection. The land isn't paying for it. And so there's a pushback and a concern that they'd almost choose to say, well, we're going to have to let more burn because we can't. The land won't pay for the protection.
Thank you. Before we go on, Senator Roger Beyer is stepped into the room. Do you want to come up now, or do you want to wait? He's made his presence, Senator Roger Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You hit Charlie. I'll wait until you're done.
Go ahead. I'm going to be going at length for a while.
Okay.
He tends to go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator for District 9, which my district covers western Oregon, the eastern part of the valley, and lots of timberland. I have more trees and people by a long ways. And I'd like to respond a little bit to Representative Hass's question about who are the timberland owners that are not being protected or who are not paying the full bore. I guess I would say I am one of them. So when and if this bill gets to the Senate, I will be declaring a conflict of interest on the bill because I am not only a timber owner in the Willamette Valley and in Central Oregon, but I'm also a board member on the Clackamas Marion Forest Patrol Association, which are the associations made up of private timberland owners and citizens around the state who will work with the Department of Forestry on setting the level of protection for our forest lands. And Representative Morgan spoke to Eastern Oregon and Central Oregon timber values, and that is predominantly the issue. Is that I don't have my tax bill in front of me, but we do pay a much higher rate in Central Oregon for our protection there for timber that is worth a lot less and for on land that is a lot less valuable than it is in Western Oregon. So that's predominantly where the subsidy, I guess you could say, comes from. On that issue, though, I'd like to start out by in my testimony by thanking OFIC and the work group and others, and specifically Mike Deitzel, who we have for years as timberland owners been saying we provide a lot of protection for our timber and for our land in the state of Oregon, and it's not recognized. And for the first time in my history, they did a lot of work for this work group to put a value on that protection that is already paid for and we and never been recognized before. And it was surprising even to me to see, I think it came out to be about one-third of the protection costs were provided by landowners without any recognition. And that, and it's just stuff that we have to do and we've always done. So I'd like to thank Mike in particular for the work he did on that issue, because it was important to have that data so we it's kind of set the stage. What I'd like to talk to you about today, and I've passed out, hopefully you've got it now, it's, and it was provided to me by Charlie Stone. It's a history of the emergency fire cost funding in Oregon. And I asked Charlie to provide that for me because I've been involved with this process for a long time. There's others in the room who have been in it longer than I have, but as I look at who's in the legislature and the history they have with it, not many people have the history I do with this issue. I first was elected or appointed, I don't remember how it happened now, to the Clackamas Marion Forest Patrol Association. I think it was in 1984. It may have been 83, it may have been 85, but it was somewhere right in that area. So I've had about 20 years of dealing with this issue. And it was interesting to get this history that Charlie put together of this issue and provided for me, because it brought back some memories, the kind of stuff that I'd even forgotten about, of what we've gone through during the years. But the thing I want to talk about today specifically, Representative Morgan mentioned it briefly, was the surcharges and when the landowners and the timber owners in Oregon pay these surcharges to fund these fire costs. Under current law, I think it's a $15 million cap, is that correct? Where we pay into it by timber harvest tax, by improved lot assessments, and by minimum lot size assessments. I think those are the only three, aren't they?
Did you say harvest tax?
I did say harvest tax, yes. And so we pay these taxes or these fees until there is a fund of $15 million is built up, and then when we reach that, then those fees go away until you drop below $15 million. Well, in 1983 or 84 or 85, whenever it was, when I first got onto the board, I remember the District Forest Report every year was the same. It was the fund is full, and it will be full for the rest of our lives, so we never have to worry about paying that tax again. Well, if you look on the back page of what I've given you, you'll see it doesn't directly say it, but it gives you how much was paid by insurance in every year from 73 through 04. And you can see there what those zeros represent was years where there were not bad fires, and you will see that in the early 80s and through about 87, there was very little paid out by the insurance fund. And those are those years I'm speaking of, where the fire fund was full, and at that time I think the cap was at $6 million, not 15 that it is today. So what you have is a scenario where when we get times of good weather, good weather for fire fighting, not good weather for fire, like last year was. This fund will build very rapidly. And again, you saw it again in the early 90s where the fund fills up. And then the surcharge goes away. Well, that's the part I want to talk about, because the surcharge on improved lots and specifically improved lots, but also minimum lot size, was a very contentious issue when it first came in. And it's an issue I think is appropriate, even though people in my district have been calling me when they see this bill now and said, why are you charging us on our homes, basically is what it is, homes in the forestry, in the forest, for fighting fires when the forestry department doesn't protect our homes, the rural fire departments protect our homes. And that was an issue we struggled with. I think it was 91, but it may have been 89. Charlie probably knows for sure when we first put the surcharge on improved lots. And the issue is that fire does not recognize property lines, but it does become more expensive to fight fire when there are homes there. Even if the forestry department per se isn't protecting that home, you know, there might be a rural fire truck or crew standing by trying to protect the home, but it makes it more expensive for the Department of Forestry to fight the wildland fires when their home's there. And that's what the legislature recognized at that time and put the surcharge on improvements, homes, virtually in the forest land. And I think that's a good solution at that time, and it served us well for the last 15 years. But the issue is now, at what level do those surcharges and those fees go away? And this committee has determined that $22.5 million is the appropriate level, and I think that is a good number. It goes from 15 to 22.5. We need to have an adequate base in which to fund these programs out of with the cost of today's big fires. Then the bill would ask that the surcharge be cut in half until the fund gets to $30 million. And I think that's, you know, probably appropriate, too. It builds a little bit of a cushion there so that, you know, you don't jump over it, jump under it from one year to the next. But the question I'd like to talk to you about is, when does the surcharge kick back in then? Because if the fund we need is $22.5 million and we're going to build a reserve of $7.5 million more than that, then when we get down below the $30 million, should the surcharge come back on, or should it go down to the $22.5 million, which is at the level that the committee has determined that you need to be adequately protected before the surcharge comes back on? I would recommend that would be the point in time when the surcharge would come back into play. The bill, as it is written, says that it would come back in when you drop below $30 million. And I have no problem if that's what this committee and the committee that worked on it determines that $30 million is the adequate fund we need, then let's keep it at $30 million. But if the adequate number is actually 22.5, then I don't think we should be collecting dollars when we're above $30 million or between those ranges after we get to that $30 million number. So I would like the committee to think about that issue and make a recommendation to the subcommittee in Ways and Means as to when those funds should kick in. I think it's a good bill. This is something that is long overdue, and we need to get it passed quickly so that the Forest Department can get out and purchase their insurance. I don't know what their date is, but this bill needs to get through the process fairly quickly. So I'd be happy to answer any questions I could about the issue. Like I said, I've got a lot of history on this issue, and if I can be any help, I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Well, thank you, Senator Beyer. Any questions for Senator Beyer?
Let's ask one for clarification, and that has to do with the fund itself that we're talking about. When does that kick in to start paying out? Is it after insurance, before the insurance? Is it in that? When do we start using that money? So that.
Yeah, I think Charlie's the best person to answer that question, because this under current law, this changes current law how that happens, but I think the changes are good, because current law you've got a deductible and then the fund pays, or the fund pays. I don't remember exactly, but Charlie would be the best person to answer that question.
Chair Smith, Representative Roebling, once we start bringing extra resources, what we call them, onto a fire. That's anything that's beyond the regular district budget. Then there is a district deductible. The district's still expected to pay up to $25,000 of extra costs per day or per fire, and they also have a percent of their budget that has to be expended on extra costs before they get into the OFLPF. But this the fund that Senator Beyer has been talking about is the next step, and that's where the money comes from for the first $15 million under the proposal and under the current structure for the 0305 biennium. It's going to drop back down to $10 million if the bill doesn't take place. But it is the first place that we go to for emergency costs after the district budget.
And before the insurance.
And before the insurance, yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Follow-up question, and maybe just a statement. So, in fact, this is that kind of reserve fund that protects the general fund and others, or not?
No, the reserve fund that is talked about in the bill is kind of a little side fund that'll be created and will mitigate the next layer above this layer of funding, which is the gap between when you burn through the landowners fund, then there's a gap in there before the insurance policy kicks in, and that fund is to mitigate the risk to the general fund there.
We may well have terminology problems through this bill from the standpoint, but the OFLPF, the one that the landowners pay into, is the first one that expends on emergency costs. We're proposing to have another fund that goes beyond that before insurance.
Thank you.
And it just as a, to lay out another card here, the funding that describes how we fight fire in the state is probably one of the most complicated funding formulas that I've encountered in my legislative career. And then how the fund is disbursed through the local protective associations is also very complicated.
I'm glad to hear you say that. That is truly overwhelming.
Thank you.
Yeah, just a statement. But it has worked. I mean, in each of the cases, we tend to get to the fire quickly, we do the things that we need to, and we work all that out. So, I mean, the funding sources have worked, and it appears to me that they've worked on this long and hard to make sure that that will continue, that you don't worry about that. You worry about fighting the fire first. These funds will kick in and take care of what needs to happen as time goes on.
Madam Chair, yeah, and that's a good point. I think, I don't know if you, Charlie has the numbers someplace, but if you look someplace at the fund, because the Forestry Department goes back and collects from insurance and from landowners who may be responsible or other responsible parties, but they wait until after the fire is out. And in fact, I think the fund is still owed money from 2 years ago still. Isn't that correct, Charlie, that we're still trying to get the money back in? But we get the fires out first, and that's the most important thing.
At this point, I think we're all clear on the big fire seasons of 2001, 2002. We're still paying back the districts from the fund in some cases. On, I think, the 2003 fire season, we've done all the audits. We're ready to close those out, and we're just dealing with 2004 season, really, at this point. We were hung up for a long time in getting some of our reimbursements and making some of our payments, but that's pretty well cleared up now.
Great. Well, thank you, Senator. Do you want to stay or do you want to go? You're welcome to do whatever.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. And thank you for saying thank you to all the landowners who pay into these funds. I too am one of them. I will be declaring my conflict later. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Yes, Chair Smith, members of the committee, again, Charlie Stone for the Department of Forestry. And Representative Morgan has done an excellent job of setting the table here for me in terms of the policy issues and what the work group has worked through. Before I go section through the bill, there's just one piece I want to touch on, and I believe you've got written testimony from me there. I will not read the written testimony.
Thank you very much.
It's extensive.
Don't.
For the sake of the record and the history of the bill that we may have to look back on later.
Okay.
But there is one element in there, and it talks about what happens if we don't pass House Bill 2327 or some form of legislation. That in the 2003 session, House Bill 2301 was passed to kind of take care of a short-term need. These issues all started to come up back in 2003, and we weren't able to work through a comprehensive long-term solution at that point. So we put into place some mechanisms that allowed us to get through this 03-05 biennium. Prior to this biennium, the expenditure limit on the fund was $10 million. That was the obligation of the landowner's money. And then the insurance deductible at that point was also $10 million. So as soon as we went through the landowner money, we had insurance money available. In 2003, the insurance carriers were telling us that after the two seasons with the big claims, that they weren't going to write a policy for anything less than a $15 million deductible. Well, the landowners responded and were willing to say that, you know, they were willing to have their fund piece go up to a $15 million expenditure limit. But that sunsets at the end of this biennium with the expectation that there'd be further discussions. And so if a bill isn't passed, that limit drops back down to $10 million, but the insurance carriers are going to drop the deductible back down to $10 million. And so we have the potential exposure to the general fund for that $5 million in between if we do nothing. And then the bill also went on to say that the OFLPF can't pay for and buy the insurance policy for the 2005 season. And I presume to hold everybody's feet to the fire, essentially, and get something done here this session. But that means that, again, if there is no bill, then if the state, if the legislature or some other means decides we still should have insurance, then not only do we have that exposure to costs, but wherever the insurance deductible is, that's going to determine how much premium. And if we have a $15 million $1 million deductible, which is the least we can get, that's about a $3.8, $3.9 million premium that would also have to come from somewhere other than the OFLPF. So that's kind of the downside or the repercussions if something doesn't happen. Now, our proposal, of course, is House Bill 2327, not saying that the legislature has no other choices, but that's kind of the table setter in terms of what could happen if we don't take some appropriate action. Now, if you'd like, I'd go ahead and start talking through the bill on a section-by-section basis. First of all, the bill has a bit of a preamble, and that has no actual value in the law. It doesn't cause anything to happen or prohibit anything from happening. But it makes a few key points, and Representative Morgan has already touched on those in part. And basically it says that fire suppression benefits everybody in the state of Oregon through all the different mechanisms that she talked about, and then it says that the general public also shares in the cause of the fires, and I think we showed some of that information the other day in the general overview hearing. But about a third of our fires are lightning caused, and then a third of them are caused by the general public at large, and a third of them are caused by the landowners and their activities on the land. It makes the point that it's better to suppress fires when they're small or prevent them. That's certainly the least cost way to go about things. And that it's fiscally inefficient to gear up the kind of a fire department or forestry department that we'd need to be able to put out every fire when it's small during every circumstance. We'd have to have folks stationed all over the countryside, and we do have an extensive fire department, and we do deal with most of those. In fact, I think we talked about our performance measure of 94% of fires extinguished at 10 acres or less, and we try to meet that goal, and that's kind of what we're budgeting for in terms of the success rate. But again, as Representative Morgan pointed out, when you get multiple fires started at the same time, that's when we need some additional assistance, and that's what the severity funding is about. So again, it's setting up the conditions and what we talked about so much in the budget note group. And for all those reasons, then the bill goes on to start laying out some changes. Section 1, of course, just indicates that Sections 2 and 3 are new law and will be added to the forestry chapter, Chapter 477. Section 2 of the bill, and this is where we start getting into some of the key items, first of all establishes that, that we want to have this proposal or this policy element that we try to get to closer to a true 50-50 sharing of the cost between the general fund and the landowners. And in fact, there isn't a whole lot that comes out of this bill when we get to the other end, if it goes according to the way the proposal is, that changes that ratio in the near term. The landowners will still be paying closer to 60% and the general fund closer to 40%, even if this bill goes through and we fund it in the way that we have over the past biennium. But we wanted to open that door and start having those discussions about how in the future perhaps more severity money could come into the process, or there might be a change in the sharing at the district level budgets in those high fire prone districts, some other things that could eventually bring that to a 50-50. It doesn't happen with this bill by itself. Then it goes on in this section to talk about formalizing the severity process in the budget, and directs the state forester to biennially submit a general fund appropriation request for these dollars, and it lists what those can be spent on. And the first item, of course, is the provision of half of the cost of the insurance policy if we continue to do that. It allows for the acquisition of centralized contingency resources, similar to what we did last summer with the helicopters and air tankers to fill in when we found out that the federal air tanker fleet was going to be off the line, at least at the early part of the season. It talks about enhancing district resources in limited cases. This is that the issue of the districts that have a harder time being able to fully fund an adequate level of protection. We might try some pilot projects through this to, say, put a helicopter at John Day or Prineville right from the start of the fire season to enhance that district. And for the record, I want to say that if that happens and if it's successful and it really plays out, then it isn't our intent to continue to fund that through this mechanism, but to look at other ways to do that, and either through the district budget or by changing the ratios and that type of thing. But it is intended to be a pilot project type of process. And then the true severity mechanism that we've used off and on for a few years, where we look at the forecast, we look at the fuel conditions, and when things are creeping up there in late July and in middle August, if we've got a lightning forecast for the Klamath Lake District, then we can move 10 more engines down to Klamath Falls from the contractors, or put a helicopter on a call when needed, availability on a 5-day call up, and stick it at LeGrand or Medford or whatever, to be ready to take off right when the fires go. And as Representative Morgan has indicated, those are the kinds of actions that have really been successful in these last couple of years to keeping fires small, and been some great saves through that kind of mechanism. And then Section 2 goes on to talk about this new contingency fund that we're talking about. Actually, Section 2 provides that any monies that are left over from this appropriation at the end of a biennium would be transferred from the Forestry Department to this contingency fund. And basically, the two funds, the OFLPF, which already exists, and this fund that we propose, are a separation of the landowner money and the general fund money, because they in the scheme, they come into play at different times, and so it isn't absolutely necessary, I suppose, that they be kept separate, but it makes a accounting of all those types of things more simple, and you see who's paying what and where it's being distributed out. Section 3 then in the bill establishes that contingency fund, and also provides that any interest that's earned on the fund would be kept in the fund. And it continually appropriates that fund to the Department of Forestry, but strictly for use in filling the gap. Once the OFLPF expenditure limit is reached, then this Oregon Fire Protection Contingency Fund would begin to pay for those emergency costs, and could be up to the amount before we get to whatever insurance deductible is set. And, of course, we're proposing through this to shop a $25 million insurance deductible. Section 4 of the bill says that Section 5 will be added to the series in Chapter 477 that deals with landowner responsibilities and liabilities. And then Section 5, we talked about a little bit. This is the section that says that a jurisdictional agency can't chase a landowner off when they're trying to protect their own land, fighting a fire either on their land or on adjacent land, as unfortunately has sometimes occurred in the past. I think our trained professional firefighters are so ingrained with the idea of levels of training and equipment that they have to have personal protective equipment. They see a landowner out there taking action, they say, you can't be here, you don't have the training, you don't have the equipment. Well, they can be there. It's their land that they're protecting, and you want to make sure that that's clear. It's a cooperative effort. At the same time, the section also says, now if those folks are out there uncoordinated with the fire with the agency action, and they're going to light a back burn or a burnout type thing, and they don't know where the other people and equipment are, then yeah, we need to stop them from doing that and take action to make sure that it's a coordinated effort. But we're not trying to discourage coordinated cooperation between the landowners and the jurisdictional agencies, and ensure that they can take action to protect their land when they see fit.
And that's addressed in number 2 under Section 5.
Yes.
Thank you.
Section 6 of the bill indicates that Section 7 is added to and made a part of the series in Chapter 477 that deals with the establishment of forest protection districts and the budgeting processes for that. This is actually a kind of an add-back. This existed in the law up until 1989 when the current primary structure for funding took place. And it provides that when the regular district budget is either overspent or underspent, that you carry forward into the next year the debits or credits and adjust the assessment rate accordingly. In 1989, when this system was designed, the main effort was to try and create a cap on the amount that the landowners were exposed to through the emergency firefighting. And so they deleted this section in the law. And we still intend, again and again for the record very clearly, that the landowner costs for emergency fire costs would be capped according to the expenditure limit that's in the law. We're proposing $15 million for the next 2 years. But if overtime costs in the regular district budget or other things that are the district's responsibility go beyond the budget, then that has to be added to the next fiscal year's budget and the rate increased. Or if they have a good fire year and they don't spend the whole budget, then they get to bring that forward as a credit. And right now it's just an issue of the authority to do that process has been removed from the law, and we want to put it back in there so the process is clear. Section 8 of the bill we're now getting into amending existing law in there. And really, Sections 8 and 9, it's just a matter of adjusting the reserve base that we'll talk about further down. And I have better notes on this somewhere. I could tell you which section we're going to address with that, but just kind of moving through the bill here. But you see the only change in each of those sections is to change $15 million in the reserve base to $22.5 million. And in fact, it is $22.5 right now, but it sunsets back to $15. And it's an interesting construction. Legislative Council tells me now, they used to just say such and such section is repealed, but they have to carry all of that forward now. So in a lot of cases, we've got dual sections that deal with the law as it is now and the law that would have become at a later date. And so that's what we're addressing here. Section 10 of the bill that talks about the part of the law that establishes a minimum assessment for small lots. Currently, any lot that the per acre assessment wouldn't come up to the minimum amount, they're assessed $18 per lot. And the $3 of that goes to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, and $15 of it goes to the regular district budget. The proposed change in this section, then, is that again, when the reserve base is reached at $22.5 million, it used to be that $3 chunk that goes to the OFLPF just stopped until the fund dropped back down and would turn back on again a year. It's never been more than a year, but it could be a year, 2-3 years later that would turn back on. We've got a stair-step proposal here now, essentially, that says if the fund goes over 22.5 but not to 30, then that $3 would drop down to $1.5, or the overall minimum assessment would be $16.5. And then if it goes past $30 million, then it shuts off, and you only have the $15 assessment that goes to the regular district budget. And as Senator Beyer pointed out, the way this is constructed, if you drop below the $30 million, it goes back to the $1.5. If you drop below $22.5 million, it goes back to the full $3. Section 11 essentially accomplishes the same thing again, because of the sunsets in the reserve base situation. Section 12 of the bill is the portion that establishes the expenditure limit for the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. It's currently $15 million. It would drop back down to drop back down to $10 million. I'm sorry for the confusion. And that's what Section 13 deals with. Again, dual sections. But the other key piece here is an added subsection. And this, when we talk about an annual expenditure limit, this allows the Emergency Fire Cost Committee to, through administrative rule, say when is that period of that annual expenditure. And this is a little bit of a quirk. The insurance policy is purchased from April 1st to April 1st. The normal fiscal budgets that we operate are on July 1 to June 30th. And after the 2002 fire season, because we had spent the entire expenditure limit of the fund, And then we had some large fires in May and June of 2003, still in that same fiscal year, but into a new policy year for the insurance policy. The fund couldn't pay for it, the insurance couldn't pay for it, and we had to come back to the emergency board for about, I think it was $1.3 million or something like that to pay for those fires. This would allow us to make some adjustments and have it all come from the system the way the system's designed. Section 14 of the bill is the section of the bill that deals with the, or the section of the law that deals with the reserve base and spells out a number of things that we're not trying to change here, but the fund can build up to that reserve base, and then as we talked about, the revenue shut off. The other thing that can happen, and just for background, is that if the fund is depleted with 2 or 3 years in a row of difficult fire seasons, then the Emergency Fire Cost Committee is required to borrow money from the treasurer to make sure that the fund can still meet its obligations. The fund has to pay that first $15 million, whether there's money in the fund or not. And so it would have to go borrow the money from the treasurer, and then all the rates, the 4 cents and 6 cents per acre, the $38 surcharge, the harvest tax rate, would have to be increased in the next year to make up that money and pay back the treasury. And so that's a current requirement in the law. We don't propose to change that. But then this same section of law deals with, again, the shutoff when we get to the higher levels. And as discussed, when we get to $22.5 million, it would reduce the surcharge, the per acre assessments, the minimum lot assessments, and the harvest tax each by 50%. If we get to $30 million, it shuts them off altogether and then turns them back on at those same steps coming back down the other direction. Section 15 of the bill does the same thing, again, because of the sunsets. Section 16 of the bill deals with the requirement to purchase insurance. In the law, currently, it says that the Emergency Fire Cost Committee shall purchase insurance and shall pay for it out of the OFLPF. That section sunsets in, I believe, 2006, actually. I'd have to go back and look at the notes there, but it's either at the end of the biennium or in 2006. And as we mentioned before, there's also a provision in the law, a temporary provision, that says the fund can't buy insurance for the 2005 fire season. The proposal here is to change this statute to one where each year the Emergency Fire Cost Committee and the state forester would look at the situation and determine, does it make sense to buy insurance this year? And frankly, most years, if not all years, the answer to that will be yes. But our experience in 2003 was that the premium jumped up by a big leap. The amount of coverage that they were offering us because of the capacity in the insurance markets dropped down, and there was going to be a copay type of a situation in the second tier of the insurance. It could well be in a situation like that. They'd look at the balance of the fund, look at what the weather conditions are projected to be for the next year, and say, it doesn't make sense to spend a couple million dollars on insurance for what we're going to get this year. And so it allows that possibility, as opposed to the current version in the law that simply says you shall purchase an insurance. And then it changes it to say that the premium for the insurance will be split so that the OFLPF, the way the bill is worded, can't pay more than 50%. But the proposal really, the Budget Note 3 group, is that the general fund would pay half and the OFLPF would pay half of the insurance premium.
I want to thank you guys for taking time to go over this with me earlier. But if that were to happen, is there a risk of not being able to get insurance then into the future? Because it sounds like we're one of the only places that actually gets the insurance. And would that put anything at risk?
Chair Smith, Representative Beyer, it could. There, I think, have been two other times in the 30-year history of our insurance that we've elected for one reason or another not to purchase insurance for 1 year and then went back to buying it the next year, and we were able to do that. It's another thing we'd have to take into consideration, certainly at that point, because there is the concern that if we stopped buying the insurance and the carriers didn't have a continuous flow of premiums coming in, that they might decide that they no longer were interested in insuring the state of Oregon. Like you pointed out, we are the only jurisdiction in the world that has this type of insurance. There was the province of Alberta in the year 2002 managed to get insurance. Many different states and provinces and countries have inquired over time, how do we do this, and have tried to do that and have been unsuccessful. Alberta got a policy in 2002. They immediately maxed it out with a total claim to the limits of their policy and couldn't get it anymore, and that that hurt us too in terms of our premium the next year. So there are definitely risks involved if we turn it on and turn it off.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes. Follow up the same way. How large is the underwriter pool?
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, I believe it's the insurance that we get is of the type, it's property insurance, basically. That's the pool, and it's a worldwide pool. The primary underwriter is Lloyd's of London. They typically set the price. There are a number of syndicates that then buy into the policy and fill out the full value of it. But it's a worldwide property insurance pool.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you have a question?
Chair, I was just curious, what was the mechanism for private property owners to pay the money into that pool? Does this come with their property tax bill and go through the county?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, yes, in part. Those landowners who are members of a Forest Protective Association and particularly the active associations, in some cases pay their assessment annually to the association, and then their money's transferred. In most cases, the county assessor adds it as a separate line item on the property tax bill, and it's a fire patrol assessment that's put on there, and that fire patrol assessment includes the regular district budget amounts, the OFLPF amounts, and in the case of improved lots, the surcharge amount. So those are put on that bill. In some cases also, particularly local governments and other government land, some institutes and whatnot, the Department of Forestry actually directly bills them. So it's a combination of mechanisms, but it all ends up in the same place.
Okay. Thank you.
I was just going to add that we told you it was complicated.
and part of it also is the harvest tax.
Right.
So those people are paying.
That's right. Pardon me, the Department of Revenue collects the forest products harvest tax when the timber receipts come in.
That's our next bill.
Yeah, but it's also the
Okay, getting close here. Well, getting close to the bill. Actually, I had intended to reference the various amendments as I went through this, and I haven't done that, so I'm going to have to go back and pick that up a little bit.
The dash ones?
Yes.
Yeah.
But continuing through the last four sections of the bill here, Section 17 of the bill is a one-time, and this hasn't been cleared, I don't think, to all readers of the bill, but it's a one-time appropriation that would actually be out of the 0305, the current biennium. $900,000 is what the bill says to pay half of the premium for the insurance policy for the 2005 season. I do need to disclose that that $900,000 figure was put in there when we had insurance estimates from last summer that we could get the policy for somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $1.7 million for a $25 million deductible. And so we played it conservative. We figured 1.8 and took half of that. Just within the last week, we've been starting to try and actually place the policy in anticipation of fire season. And the folks over in London have said, well, we're not sure we want to do that. We're looking at some. The figure we got back was $2.25 to $2.5 million. we're through the broker that handles this, we're pushing back pretty hard and trying to say, look, we got to have this for $2 million or less. There's no justification for that increase based on the risk levels and the past policies and that type of thing. But I do want to be clear on the record that that $900,000 figure is not firm, and when it gets to Ways and Means and when we get a better idea of what the policy is going to be, that number may have to be adjusted to deal with that.
And that we should know by the time it's in Ways and Means?
We will need to have that firmed up before we can bring the bill out of that part of the process.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Robel.
What is the upward limit of that policy generally, or is there one?
In terms of the premium?
Yeah. No, in terms of what they will pay back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the coverage, the proposal, what we're trying to shop for 2005, assuming that the bill eventually passes, is a policy that would have a $25 million deductible and then provide $25 million in coverage in excess of that. So we'd basically have $50 million in planned coverage for fires. And can we have a fire season that costs more than that? Yes, it's certainly possible. Actually, in 2002, the Department of Forestry spent $59 million in the total emergency fire suppression costs, but $30 million of that was reimbursed by the U.S. Forest Service and FEMA. And as long as we have fires that are threatening communities and all that, we're doing a better and better job of recognizing that early, applying to FEMA, getting recognition, and we hope that again, this was one of the discussion items in the budget note group. How much do we need to plan for in any given year? And we settled in the $50 to $60 million range. And right now, given the finances the way they are, we went with $50 million.
Did you have a question? Okay.
Section 18 of the bill does simply repeal two of the sections from House Bill 2301, and those are the ones that dealt with the not being able to buy insurance and then the ultimate sunset of the insurance provision. Those would be repealed. Section 19 of the bill establishes a new sunset date for the $15 million expenditure limit and would push that out to July 1 of 2007. The intent here is that the legislature can't be bound in how much general fund money it's going to give in any given biennium. And so the landowners who support the OFLPF felt that it was appropriate then that the amount that the OFLPF is going to kick in each year also, or each biennium, each also be examined. And so while the intent is a willingness to meet that obligation as long as the general public share is also there, it gets revisited every 2 years by putting this provision in. And that's very similar to the way the forest products harvest tax is operated, and you'll hear about that in your other hearing here this morning.
Thank you.
And then the last section of the bill is an emergency clause that would declare an emergency and make the bill effective March 1st so that we can, in fact, purchase insurance prior to the April 1st policy expiration. Now, I'll try to do this quickly. I'm going to shuffle some papers here to find the right pieces. But
well, it might be helpful to know we have an engrossed version of that bill with the Dashwood
yes.
amendments.
And actually, I'm... Well, I'm going to try to follow that without a hand engrossed version, but I'll dig it out if need be here. As Representative Morgan indicated, we do have some changes needed for the for the bill. On page 2 of the printed bill, in the portion that describes how the money would be spent from this severity funding, it talks about purchasing the insurance by the Emergency Fire Cost Committee. Well, that's inconsistent with the section 16 of the bill where we talk about purchase of the insurance, and that says the state forester will purchase the insurance. So we just delete the phrase by the Emergency Fire Cost Committee in that section 2 of the bill. Then the real substantive element within the amendments. As we shopped around the bill to the Forest Patrol Associations and got feedback from folks, a number of people indicated, well, you know, you've got a cap on the landowner fund. Why wouldn't you also have a cap on the general fund or the new contingency fund that we propose? And we thought, yeah, that makes sense. You don't want to keep on raking off the general fund money and just building up a fund, and particularly one that might get raided for other purposes. Heaven forbid that anybody would do that. But and so we proposed to put a $10 million cap on that contingency fund as well. And once that that cap is reached, any other money that normally would be transferred from the Forestry Department into that fund under the bill would revert back to the general fund. The fund would continue to earn interest, but not have additional surplus general fund monies transferred to it until it drops back below the $10 million level. The next amendment item is on page 3, line 1. This is the section that deals with the landowners not being kicked off their land. And we're really just trying to find, there's no ideal language, but we added the word reasonably in there. We're trying to make sure that a jurisdictional agency can't get away with kicking somebody off just because, well, you might cause something to happen that's going to put our people at risk. There has to be a reasonable expectation or likelihood that they're actually doing something that's going to cause that. The preponderance of the evidence should be, you know, the landowners get to be there and do protect their land unless there's something really truly seriously going to be amiss if they're from their actions. In line 19, and most of the rest of these elements here, I think, on page 3, page 4, there are a number of places in the current law, and I'm not sure just how we missed this over the years, but that talks about when the emergency fire cost committee determines the reserve base to be. Well, the reserve base is determined by the legislature, and it's set in statute. What the emergency fire cost committee is determining every February 16th is what the unencumbered balance of the fund will be at the end of the fiscal year. And so we make that change in several places in the bill. So it talks about when the unencumbered balance is beyond the reserve base, then those changes occur. On pages 5 and 6, lines 35 and line 4, Legislative Council added in an additional section of 477-295, which is a funding mechanism. That section of the bill limits the expenditures from those various sources, and so it just corrects and makes sure that all the appropriate sources are listed. And then on page 7, line 1 and line 40, earlier on in the development of this bill, we also were going to try and tackle a minor irritation that a bunch of the revenue sources operate on a fiscal year and the harvest tax operates on a calendar year, and we're going to try to put that all on the fiscal year. But that would really mess up the Department of Revenue. It wasn't worth the effort. We decided to just stick with it the way it is, and so we need to add the words calendar or back in to deal with that. So those are the proposals in the Dash 1 amendments. That and anything else, I'd be very happy to answer any questions, but I'd like to make the recommendation that the committee pass out this bill with a due pass recommendation amended by the Dash 1s. And what are you trying to do? Oh, that's right, fiscal impact statement. How are we doing, Chair Smith? Are we okay for time?
Okay.
I was handed the fiscal analysis here by Patrick just before the meeting started, and looked at it quickly and found that there's, I think, a couple of items in there that need to be worked with, and so I think the fiscal impact statement does a good job of describing what the bill is intending to do, and if you don't mind, I'll just let that stand and not describe those items. But on the front page, the large paragraph there, about three lines from the end, it talks about if this bill doesn't pass, or what House Bill 2301 did, and it says that the general fund is potentially exposed to a $1.8 million premium. Well, we've described to you that it's a lot more than that the general fund is exposed to if from the actions of House Bill 2301. It's exposed to all of the emergency fire costs above the $10 million expenditure limit, and if the legislature decides to purchase insurance to cover some of that, it would be exposed to a premium that reflects whatever deductible was selected. If you had a $15 million deductible, that premium would be more in the neighborhood of $3.8 million.
Plus the
$5 million gap to get there, yes. And then on the back side of the page, the third paragraph down, it's talking about that stair-step proposal, and it says that if you're at $22.5 million but less than $30 million in the fund, that the minimum assessment would increase from 15 to 16.5. Well, that's just flat wrong. It's at 18, and it would reduce to 16.5. So I'll work with the legislative fiscal to make sure they understand that and get that understanding corrected in there, if that'd be the pleasure of the committee.
Yeah, I would think so. Is that something you can do in a reason meeting, too?
Well, we'll go down and talk to the analyst and just kind of go through the issues with her and see where she's coming from and explain where the department is, and we'll work through this one.
I think it was just misread the bill, and that should be easily corrected, I would imagine.
Madam Chair.
Representative Burley.
That is kind of a confusing part of the whole thing, because the rate is 18, if I understand this correctly, the rate's 18 up to the $22.5 million. Then it drops down to 16.5 between that and 30.
That's correct.
So the portion that goes to the OFLPF is $3 up to $22.5, or $1.50 up to 30.
Also
that's
correct.
What Senator Beyer was referring to on.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
It also means that Beyer's amendment, the thing he was talking about saying it kicks back in at 22.5, is not in these amendments.
That's correct. If the committee wants to see that happen, then we'd need a recommendation or you know, an indication to at Ways and Means to amend the bill again to adjust that so that once it goes past 30, it doesn't kick back in again until it drops below 22.5. And for the department's part, at least, that seems like a reasonable approach. There's no real issue, I don't think, in doing it one way or the other. It's not that we absolutely have to have it the way that it's proposed in the bill at this time.
Okay. Is that something you can address? You said to address that part or portion in Ways and Means. Do we need to make a recommendation here?
We could address that in Ways and Means. If the committee wishes to, they could make a recommendation to Ways and Means on the issue, that the committee look at that, and it sounded like a good idea to your committee members, and you would hope that we would consider it in our discussions.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Do you want to close? Or is
it? Well, I made my closing recommendation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good bill. Should move.
Oh, I think I heard that.
Sure.
Thank you very much. We have some people who've signed up to testify. Mike Adern, Oregon Small Woodlands. Ray Wilkerson of Oregon Forest Industries. Do you want to come up together? Or do you want to come up separate? Or whatever you want to do. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Appreciate the opportunity. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent private industrial forest landowners in Oregon. As Representative Morgan noted, I was a member of the Budget Note 3 Committee, and in that capacity, I'm here today to express the support of OFIC for House Bill 2327. As has been said repeatedly, but I want to echo the fact that this is an outstanding wildland firefighting program, second to none in the world. As Representative Beyer noted, we're the only jurisdiction in the world that can purchase this kind of insurance policy we've been talking about, and that's the reason is because this department aggressively fights fire, and they just need the resources to be able to continue to do that. This is a century-old program based on a partnership between the state of Oregon and forest landowners that basically started in 1911. And it has been upgraded periodically over the years when the needs are apparent. The last time it was upgraded was in 1989, which also followed a very bad fire season in 1987. And it was apparent then to the legislature and the landowners that the financial underpinnings of the program were just inadequate to deal with those kinds of seasons. So a significant upgrade was passed in 1989. But that was the last time that occurred. And since then, in those ensuing years, both the costs and the risks of fire have increased substantially. The costs, including the insurance costs, have gone up, and the risks have gone up substantially. And just two to mention is the rural forest interface, basically rural development adjacent to forest land, which makes it much more difficult and complicated and expensive to fight fire. And then we seem to be in a long-term dry weather cycle, which is another factor that really increases the risks, and this lack of rainfall this winter is further indication of that. So this is high time to take another look at the program like we did in 89 and make sure we have the resources necessary. That's why the Budget Note 3 Committee was formed, and House Bill 2327 is a result of that. It's based on a continuation of the shared responsibility, the partnership between the state and the landowners. Basically, both sides to that partnership would be committing to increase their commitment to this program by this bill. Charlie covered a lot of the administrative stuff. The essence of the bill is the landowners would increase their commitment by 50%. Our risk exposure would go from $10 million a year to $15 million a year. The state, in turn, would increase their commitment by agreeing to share the cost of purchasing the insurance and then accepting a second increment of risk above the $15 million. That will enable us to buy an insurance policy at a lower rate, as has been discussed, because the deductible is higher, and we can plow those savings back into the initial attack that keeps the fires from getting big. So I think this is a very reasonable and responsible proposal to deal with the increased costs and risks that we see, and hope that it moves forward. So thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Wilkerson?
Okay. Representative Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Gadern. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And I'm currently on a tour with my President Mike Barnes of every chapter within the state. Oregon Small Woodlands Association has around 2,500 members who own just over 500,000 acres of family forest land. There's about 4 million acres of family forest land throughout the state. One of the things that brings us together, whether it be Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, or Green Party member, is good firefighting in Oregon. It's a major concern for all our landowners, no matter what their management objectives, be it wildlife stewardship, timber, aesthetics. Without a good firefighting program in place, people are becoming very nervous, especially with federal policy and neighboring federal lands throughout the state on family lands, to actually carry on owning forest land. We have a trend that is of interest to our members, which is the age of them. The average age of family forest landowners in 1989 was 55. Today, it's 65. They are having to sit round tables and have discussions with the next generation and amongst themselves on how are they going to transfer land. And they feel a lot of pressure and a lot of public unwillingness to firstly acknowledge their hard work to provide Oregon with a variety of benefits, but also to support them in that generational change. Now, it may be strange to have that type of conversation within an agricultural committee hearing about fire funding, but I think this committee could send a very strong message by supporting and moving this bill forward to say that the Oregon legislature and the Oregon public are there to help with firefighting costs and are there to pay an equitable share, and we will deal with the federal issues another time. That's really why we support the bill. We support the bill because it makes sense. We think it's equitable. Our board has come around and said this is one of the issues we can find consensus on, and I can tell you from my 3 years' experience that doesn't happen very often. The other thing I'd just like to mention, it's an anecdotal thing about the Lloyd's of London issue. I don't have the piece of paper in my hand, and I have tried to get it, but about 2 years ago I had a call from a friend who is one of the names of Lloyd's of London. I don't know if you understand the structure of Lloyd's of London, but basically there are a number of private individuals throughout the empire that underwrite a lot of their risk. There are increasing numbers of press reports in England about federal policy and its potential threat to insuring any sort of land throughout the Western United States. That's coming up in English press briefings. If it's coming up there, I think that really puts pressure on both the insurers and the federal solution to come up with a better solution on federal firefighting policy, which also in turn affects us. But I'd like to leave that thought with you, because that is a thought of some of the folks back in England. It's not something we can discuss maybe further here, but if the legislator could send a message that at least in Oregon we are supportive of family lands and a strong firefighting policy, that could potentially send some messages back to Washington, D.C. with our congressional delegation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just out of curiosity, you heard what Senator Beyer said about the $1.50. What do you think about that?
Representative, the $1.50 on the minimum lot,
right.
I think that would be fine. I think either way that would work. That would the real issue there on that capping the reserve fund is if these charges are go on and go off again, the taxpayers get confused. It's there and then it's not there, and then why is it back, and you know what happens? And as he said, he gets, and I'm sure a lot of people in rural areas get questions from their constituents of why am I paying this? And I think Senator Beyer answered the question very adequately, that the presence of residential structures in these zones greatly increases the difficulty of fighting fires, and the people who are living there need to help cover that cost. But it is confusing to taxpayers, and so I think what he suggested would be fine.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Blair. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. On that subject, when we were talking about where to go when we've reached the cap and then we fall below it, whether to go to the 30 or the 22. 2.5 million, would the risk of jumping back on and off at the 30 million be more confusing? And I'm not sure I'm making this clear, than if we dropped it down to 22, and then it wouldn't probably happen as often, or maybe it just doesn't happen that often anyway.
That's a good question, Representative Beyer, and there's no good answer, I'm afraid, to it. It depends on the circumstance. It is a trade-off between trying to limit. You don't want the fund to accumulate endlessly and become huge, and that's the reason for the cap. But limiting that does create the possibility, at least, of the taxes being turned on and turned off. And at a $30 million level, it's probably not likely that that's going to get. We'd have to have a lot of really good fire years in a row in order to build the fund up to that level. So, unfortunately, that's not likely to happen. But anyway, it is a trade-off in terms of where to draw that line. But either what the bill's got right now or what Senator Beyer has proposed, I think, are both good solutions.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bart Starker. Mr. Stark, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Smith, members of the committee, I'm Bart Starker. I'm a fourth generation family forest owner in Western Oregon, just west of Corvallis. And our company was started by my grandfather in 1936 while he was still professor of forestry at Oregon State. He graduated in the first graduating class of foresters in 1910. So we've been in this business for some time and been around the fire program for some time. And I think I wanted to tell you a little bit about my history in this whole thing and my experience with it. I've been a member of the Board of Forestry in the late 80s through the mid-90s, and now I'm the chair of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee that administers the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. I want to thank all the legislators and members of the working group that put this bill together, because I think this was a really collaborative and really serious group that put their heads together to come up with a real first-class solution. And I want to thank Representative Morgan for chairing that group. She did a wonderful job. This is a very Oregonian thing to do. I think it's similar to and probably has at least as much impact on the state and defines the state as does the bottle bill, public beaches, and the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. I think this is in the same range of importance to the state, and probably has more impact than either any of those others do as far as the way the state looks over time. We're very proud of our firefighting system in the state, and it's unique to this state. All the other states that I'm aware of are strictly general funded. There aren't any landowner contributions to the firefighting effort in any other western state that I'm aware of. So we are proud of this system, and I think the landowners are very supportive and want to be involved in the system and continue to be involved and really our first class piece of the whole puzzle to make sure it works. This legislation builds on a unique collaborative cooperative protection system, and certainly from my experience and from what my grandfather used to tell me is fire protection is the prerequisite to a forestry investment. You can't really justify any kind of investment in forestry unless you can have some reliability of fire protection to make sure you don't get burned out on a regular basis. My grandfather TJ used to tell me that you don't start practicing forestry until you have your snags down. And that was because of his history through the big fires in this state. He certainly amended that statement in his later years when habitat and snags became important for various kinds of wildlife. And he said, get your snags down on the ridges. Make sure you don't have any snags on the ridges. But he certainly saw the importance of fire protection for all his whole life. And he passed it on to the rest of us. This bill builds on the shared responsibilities of this fire protection system, not only in the fire causes, certainly there you've had that described to you today, that the fire causes are both public and landowner causes, and there's a mix of all those things that take place, therefore the share in the costs and so forth. The values protected are certainly also shared in watershed and habitat protection, and as well as economic and timber values, and certainly that because of those shared values, we think we have a logical system of sharing the costs, both public and private. So I would certainly urge you to seriously consider moving this bill forward, and certainly the Emergency Fire Cost Committee needs your help in moving this bill so that we can purchase the insurance that protects all of us from the catastrophic fire. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stark. And thank you for all your years of service to Oregon. Are there any questions for the gentleman? Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Greg Addington, Oregon Farm Bureau. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And the Farm Bureau, we represent about 8,500 farming ranch families in Oregon. And you may wonder why why our interest or involvement in this issue, but many of those members have forest land of some sort or another, whether it's several thousand acres here on the west side or less than 100 somewhere else. Many of those are part of farming and ranching operations that are the primary part, but there is a lot of our members that own forest land. I was part of the work group, the Budget Note 3 Committee, and I was thankful for that, for being included in that. It was a tremendous learning opportunity for me. As you all are finding out, these are pretty complex issues, and it was my pleasure to serve on that committee. One thing that I came to the realization of is that, as you've heard articulated here, Oregon has a unique method of fighting fire, an proven method, and it seems to me that this bill only improves on that. It focuses on the initial attack, which is clearly key in wildland firefighting. And with that, I just wanted the chance to get on the record and show our support for this bill and ask you to please support the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Addington? No. Thank you very much. Is there anybody here in the audience that hadn't signed up that wanted to comment on this bill before we close? Do you want to come forward? Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Chair Smith, committee, for the record, my name is Bill Cluding. I represent the Western Council of Industrial Workers, over 4,000 members in this state, and we're all directly tied to timber. Not only us, but there's thousands and thousands of other families out there that their whole life is wrapped around timber that we are able to get to our mills. Every catastrophic fire we have can shut down one whole mill complex. And for the record, this state cannot afford to lose any more jobs. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2327, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2327. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt House Bill 2327-1, amendments dated January 19, 2005.
Thank you. Representative Buckley has moved that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2327. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1 amendments? Seeing none. Is there any objection? None. We are adopting the Dash 1 amendments. Representative Berquist.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2327 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Berquist has moved House Bill 2327 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion or comment?
Now would be the time to ask.
Do you want to make comments or ask questions?
Well, I'm curious if we want to, are we going to recommend that Ways and Means that they look at that $1.50 question?
I think we need to maybe discuss that as a committee. We could certainly send it as a note along with the bill if we want to have that addressed, that the issue that Senator Breyer brought up. I think that would be a good idea. Do we want to discuss that as a committee, or we just want to have Patrick send it as a budget note or as a note? Representative Wilburn.
Representative Chair, thank you. I think that as I've looked at it and studied it, I think we need to express to the committee to truly look at that issue. I think the issues that have come up about going back and forth and one year not and the next year having it do make it something that needs to be considered. And I think they did establish as a group that $22.5 million was the kind of the floor. It'll take a while to get there. It'll take a while longer to get up to the $30 million. But from that $30 million back down, I think it's reasonable during that period that they wait until it gets back down to start over and then impose the full 18 until it gets above the $22.5 again and then, you know, take that, excuse me, the little less there. So for me, it seems a reasonable thing. I would like them to consider it in Ways and Means.
Is there any objection to them considering that?
Can I ask?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification. So you're talking about down to the 22.5 after it gets to the 30?
It goes to the 31st, and then you don't reimpose the taxing until it gets back down to the 22.5, and then you start building it back again.
Thank you. I thought I heard you down below 22.5.
Well, I think it'll hit that point, and that's when it's going to hit that 22.5. That's the time when you start looking at it.
And that's a discussion I can
that's
have.
A discussion I can have.
Right. I think we'll make that recommendation then.
Was that going to be a part of the motion? Make a separate motion. I think we could do it either way, but it needs to be part of a motion. Our rules require us to that a recommendation be voted on by the committee.
Okay. So we'd want a separate. We already have a motion on the table.
Either we could do
yes, I think we could
motion.
Deal with this motion and make a third motion to for the recommendation, perhaps.
Okay. So we have a motion on the floor to move House Bill 2327 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'd like to raise one issue that we should probably put in a, or convey, and I think maybe just convey to Representative Morgan. So Lloyd's in London high risk pool at this point in time, and mind you, I'm deeply involved in it on a day-to-day basis, is very small. And speed is the essence at this point. The first fire that creeps up in Southern California, we could watch our entire insurance pool vaporize in front of us. So, and I do realize that this funding is 2003-2005 funding, so therefore there may be a abbreviated process. But speed is the essence here of getting that insurance policy acquired, or the general fund will be sucking it up outright.
And I think that's the objective of moving this bill today to Ways and Means for us. Duly noted. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Bocas?
Aye.
Representative Gurley?
Aye.
Representative Pass?
Aye.
Representative Roseland?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. We now need a motion. Representative Burley, would you like to make a motion on other recommendations?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that we recommend to Ways and Means that they consider the $1.5 for the special assessment between the $22.5 million and $30 million.
I'm not going to try to repeat all that. We have a motion on the floor for the Ways and Means to look at the issue of the fund from $22.5 million to the $30 million, the $1.50 assessment, correct?
Yes.
All right. Any discussion?
Is part of that recommendation that idea that they would not reimpose until it gets down to 22.5, or is it just...
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. Then I...
Okay. We can do it. Is there any objections? Okay, we pass. The motion has passed, and we'll close the work session. House Bill 2327. And Representative Morgan left the building.
You just got to find money quick.
Well, I just want to thank the task force and everybody who's worked and participated on that for all your hard work on that effort. That's huge. Thank you. We have about 15 minutes left. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2122. Patrick, do you want to tell us a little bit about what that bill does?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 2122 extends the period in which the forest product harvest tax is imposed and will establish rates for the extended period. This measure has a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue. Because of that, we have the measure has no fiscal impact, as it says in the staff measure summary. We have received what's called a hall pass from the Revenue Committee, which means that the revenue impact will be determined once it's at the Revenue Committee. But the bill has a subsequent referral to Revenue.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll call Clark Seeley and Hal Salvester. You can come up together and tell us even more about this bill. Good morning.
Good morning.
morning, Chair Smith, members of the committee. I'm Clark Seeley, and I'm the Associate State Forester of the Oregon Department of Forestry. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning and testify on House Bill 2122. I'll try and be very brief and just answer any questions that you have. This bill amends Oregon Statute 321.015, which is the body of law that establishes the Oregon Forest Products Harvest Tax. And the law is structured today such that two of the rates for the tax sunset every 2 years. And this bill comes before the legislature each session to consider renewal of rates and adjust those rates accordingly based on budget and revenue. For the Department of Forestry, the harvest tax supports not only the fire program that you've heard about this morning, but also is a major funding source for our administration of the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and has been that way for the last 25 years or so. The bill and the use of harvest tax maintains the shared responsibility concept of administration of the Forest Practices Act by both operator and landowner taxes through this bill, as well as the general fund support that comes into the program. Very briefly, the tax rates are set on a per 1,000 board foot harvested rate or basis, and the rates are calculated each biennium considering three factors: the ending balance that we have in the bank today based on tax that's been collected, if there is an ending balance, the projected budget requirements by the agency for the next 2 years for the following biennium, and then our forecasted harvest levels for the next 2 years. And each of those three factors come into play to determine a final rate proposed for the following 2 years. I've included two attachments, charts in our testimony this morning, just to give you a picture about the harvest levels in the state over time, as well as the harvest tax rate amounts, again, over time. We are on somewhat of now of after falling harvests over the last 15 years or so, based on federal harvest rate declines. We are now at somewhat of a stabilized level of about 4 billion board feet per year harvested in the state, and the harvest tax rates kind of have reflected that stability. The rate itself is collected by the Department of Revenue as part of their regular taxation program, and on a quarterly basis, the harvest taxes that are collected are transferred to the entities, including the Department of Forestry. We're now we've received six of the eight transfers that would normally occur during this biennium so far. There'll be another one next month in February, and then a final one for this biennium in May. And at that point, then we'll actually know what the full revenue is for this biennium, and then we'll actually be able to calculate the rate itself for the purposes of this bill. Of course, the other thing that will come into play is that our budget will be considered along that same timeline. And so what we have done in the past is to recommend to you that we not set rates today. We don't have all the information, of course, in the system yet to do that, but that as we move along, this bill gets considered along with our budget bill. Let me just very briefly mention one point of technical clarification in the drafting of the bill, and that is that legislative counsel inadvertently modified the harvest tax rate for that portion of the tax dedicated to fire suppression that you all just talked about. That particular rate actually doesn't sunset in the law as it does for forest practices and research, and so it was simply an oversight on their part, and that modification in the drafting actually should not have occurred. It's found on line 14 of the introduced bill. You can see it, the 50 cents per thousand for fire was modified in the drafting of the bill, but that is the error, and that should simply remain as 50 cents per thousand. There was no proposal to change that. Again, I think that we can correct that change at the time that the final rates are actually put into the bill. So, in summary, appreciate the opportunity to be here. Be glad to answer any questions you have, and thank you again for your time this morning.
Any questions for Mr. Seeley? None? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the Dean of the College of Forestry and the Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory. at Oregon State University, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2122 in principle. The in principle is because we don't know what the rate is going to be yet. The harvest tax is linked directly to the Forest Research Laboratory appropriation, and combined, those two revenue sources provide the foundation support for our scientists at the Forest Laboratory who work on forestry and forest products research and technology development for the state. They leverage the state investment at a rate of about $5 per dollar of forest research lab appropriation or the harvest tax. It's actually, when you combine those two, it's $2.50 per state dollar that's coming in. That's a significant amount of money. It's $12 to $13 million a year that's coming in, much of it from outside the state, federal grants and contracts that brings jobs and helps us build the forest science capacity in the state. The tax rate is currently at 67 cents per thousand board feet. When you combine that with the governor's proposed budget for 2005-2007, it would not maintain capacity in the Forest Research Lab to serve the forest industry of this state. We have been losing capacity since the start of 2001, and the current proposed appropriation for the FRL would cause another 1.5 scientist years to be reduced. Overall, that would amount to a 27% reduction in capacity since 2001. And why is that significant? Well, it's significant because the forest industry in this state generates $12.5 billion in total economic activity every year, supports 190,000 jobs, 88% of which are in rural communities. The forest sector is the backbone of many rural communities' economic and social infrastructure, and our programs at the Forest Research Lab are directly focused on helping the forest sector maintain its competitive advantage nationally and internationally. So, in conclusion, we support the bill in principle. If the harvest rate stays high, then perhaps we can backfill some of the proposed reduction in the FRL. If it goes lower, obviously we're going to lose even more capacity. Whether it goes up, goes down, stays the same, we'll work very closely with the Forest Resource, the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and the small woodland owners to make sure that our investments are focused on their needs. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ray Wilkerson. I think you'll get off too lazy, huh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm Ray Wilkerson of the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I'd like to briefly go on record and express the support of OFIC for this bill. As was indicated earlier, the bill includes blank lines for the rates for these two programs right now, and so our testimony today is in support of the programs and the basic, as the previous bill, we discussed the notion of shared responsibility and partnership, and we're happy to continue our partnership with the Department of Forestry and the Forest Practices Act and with the Forest Research Lab in promoting forest research in this state. The details, I think, we're going to have to wait till later in terms of how to fill in those blanks. If the governor's cutting general fund to the Forest Research Lab, that's something we want to talk about and probably not be real happy about, and maybe we can get some changes there that will prevent an increase in our taxes. But so I think we've got a ways to go before we can make those kind of final decisions. But in terms of the philosophy of these two programs and the notion that we are willing to continue to bear a share of the costs, and we are, and so we're in support of the bill.
Thank you. I guess my only question would that be taken up in revenue then?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if this bill also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means past revenue. If it doesn't, it's going to have to, I think. Traditionally, Mr. Seeley's correct, this bill comes up every 2 years. But it ultimately ends up in Ways and Means because the Forest Practices Program is split 60% general fund, 40% harvest tax. And in order to know what the 40% rate is, you have to know what the 60% general fund contribution is, and that's not decided until the Department of Forestry's budget is finalized later in the session. So one way or another, I think this bill usually ends up in ways, it goes to three places rather than two, and I think it'll probably have to again for that reason.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wants to comment on this? Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2122. Before I open the work session, do you want to see if Representative Beyer is, see if she's out in the hall?
Do we need to call a break?
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2122. Representative Roblin.
Madam Chair, I move the House Bill 2122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Roblin has moved House Bill 2122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
I just think it's important to know what Mr. Seeley pointed out, and that was line 14, the 50 cents should not be deleted. But that was a mistake. Is that, yeah. I'm correct in that?
Not deleted.
No. Well, they struck 50 cents. It should stay in there.
Right.
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm representing Haas and are both on revenue, and we can, I'm sure, track to make sure the 50 cent mark is added back to when it comes through.
Great.
And I would have
thank
no
you.
Problem in the actual
motion
that it be included. So I agree. And either any way it goes, it's fine.
Okay.
I think
just note it.
We'll
get it.
I'll speak this death of revenue.
Right. It sounds like this bill has a lot more to do on it.
Yeah.
But since we're the starting place, any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Yes.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative
Pass? Aye.
Representative Sumner? Aye. Aye. Okay, 2122 passes. And the Committee on Revenue. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2122. And committee, just for you, we're going to meet Friday at 9 o'clock as our next committee meeting. And then I'm going to try to be flexible on the Mondays and Fridays depending on where the committees are meeting. Now that they've moved forward to 8:30, it seems until we get a longer floor session, maybe we should switch to Mondays. So I think depending on the calendar. So watch those agendas.
Okay.
Try to give you Fridays off maybe instead of Monday. We'll see how that works. So with that, we're adjourned till Friday morning. Thank you.